I think I'm preaching to the preach, to be honest, here today. No surprise. What happened to the activist student community in the 60s and the walk-ins and the lecture theatres and listening to what people actually had to say that was meaningful rather than getting pissed out of the face in Freshers Week, but never mind. I did organise some notes that I was going to use, but bad preparation and a trip to Birmingham and then London last night destroyed that. So I'll free flow, so if I start waffling or something, just throw something at me. I'm not gonna really reiterate the sequence of events that happened, because to be honest, I think we've all read and heard what's happened, so it'll be a waste of time and I don't want to keep you here for too long. But I will sum up and I will clarify some issues and points that have been raised on campus, in the press, and just overall through conversation. And one of those, the first one, is that the Al-Qaeda training manual that was downloaded from the United States Department of Justice website, not the Federation of American Scientists. It was a 140-page document that did not have a chapter on explosives. It had a chapter on targeted assassinations, and it had a chapter on how to grow ricin. But there was nothing of a nature that said, join the earth wire to the life and put nails in a carrier bag and you've got a bomb. That would be of no use to me for my MA dissertation, which was a comparison of the tactics of Al-Qaeda and Hamas, the military tactics, that is. But also for the PhD that I was applying for at the time, and had sent the document to Hisham because he was helping me and advising me on how to draft and word the proposal. So I would send him things quite frequently for him to review and say, Hisham, I'm using this for reference purposes, or I will be looking at this material in the future. And then he would say, yes, this is a good source. When I discovered the Al-Qaeda training manual, to be honest, a jitter went up my spine, because I thought, fantastic, I've got a real substantive document here, a primary document that would allow me to analyse the tactics of Al-Qaeda and use that in my analysis for my dissertation and the future upcoming PhD. So yes, it had no chapter on explosives, and the reason why I sent him the document was not because Hisham was abusing the printing position that he had in the Modern Languages Department, but instead because he was advising me and assisting me in drafting the PhD proposal. Now, the university's line. Has the university curtailed academic freedom? And I'm doing a dissertation on this now, how Britain's, it's obviously quite relevant, Britain's counter-terrorism measures and how they're curtailing academic freedom. The university has been played for sucker by the government. Freedom of speech, so I'm allowed to say that. But the right-wing press and the scaremongering and the whipping up of the so-called enemy within and the Islamist threat has been perpetrated in such a way by certain institutions, including the government and the media, that the university has sadly fallen victim to the kind of overt Islamophobia and xenophobia that is being practiced and overtly conducted in our society. Now, we all know, had this been a John Smith who sent the document to an Alan Smith, it would never have happened. The point is that the fact that we are two Muslims, I am brown and I blatantly look like I'm a Muslim. Hisham is Algerian. Algerians, by the way, are the most watched individuals in Britain at the moment. That certainly had a role to play. So to be honest, I feel sorry for the university that they've kind of fallen sucker to the whole kind of whipping up of the press and the government line. However, that does not justify what the university has done. Because, I mean, they said they carried out a risk assessment and, you know, they'd taken certain protocols and taken certain decisions before calling the police onto campus. It's all nonsense. The point is this, you need to ask yourself, had the university conducted a risk assessment, what level would that risk assessment have to have been conducted for them not to have called the police? You know, the fact is that you've got a Muslim guy, okay, who's Algerian, forget his track record, the fact that he's been in Nottingham for 13 years, you know, he's been an undergrad here and he's done some postgrad research here, and the fact that he's working at your institution, I mean, that's all out the window, it's a load of bollocks. We don't really care about that. The point is that he's a Muslim and this enemy within, I mean, he could be an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell. So the university has called the police onto campus, and the police, without conducting any prior investigation, granted to them by the draconian and ambiguous and overreaching legislation, anti-terror legislation that they've been granted, has come onto campus and arrested Hisham. I do not believe that they came onto campus just to arrest Hisham. I think that some subtle inquiry was conducted, and that the police came onto campus looking for two individuals. One was Mr. Yeza and one was Mr. Sabir. Because when I was approached in the toilet in the Trent building, I was told by one of the arresting officers that he was looking for somebody of a similar description to me. Not only that, but when I was taken to the Bridewell police station, preparation had been conducted to detain two people. I mean, the windows had been sealed off, two separate blocks of the police station had been closed off. So they were certainly coming to arrest two individuals. I think I was lucky in one context, because you could say that I walked into trouble that morning because I was worried about Hisham's welfare. And I was, I genuinely was. I can be nosy sometimes, but can't we all? You know, I was approached by a member of staff in the Modern Languages Department who asked me about Hisham's welfare. Now, if somebody says to you, "Is Hisham okay?" you automatically draw the inference that something may have happened to Hisham. So I said, "Well, I don't know. I'll go and find out." So I went up to his office, and there was a security chap there, and I said to him, "Is Hisham okay?" And he said, "I don't know, and even if I did know, I'm not at liberty to tell you." And I said, "That's fine." So I rang Hisham. There was no reply. I left him a voicemail, and I sent him a text message. Within 15 minutes of the text message, I received a call from Hisham saying that I'm absolutely fine and I'm making my way into university. That's it. It was over for me. That's all it was. Anyway, the point is, I got arrested and I was detained. Now, the Nottingham case quite clearly highlights the threat to academic freedom under current terror legislation. Now, I'm not going to go into a raging debate as to, you know, how much free speech we have. That's for philosophers like John Stuart Mill to do, not for me. But what I can certainly say is that the current parameters that have been adopted in the anti-terror legislation have draconian consequences for any academic, especially of a Muslim, South Asian or Arab nature, to be conducting research on volatile issues. The fact that you're a Muslim or you're an Arab or of South Asian descent is used, or can be used and is used against you. So the fact that I'm a Muslim and I was conducting research on this subject meant that I may be using that as a covert method of sabotage or espionage against the system. So if you're white, you know, which most people are in this university, I think, don't quote me on that, then I'd say you're pretty safe if you want to research Islamic terrorism or Al-Qaeda or Hamas or anything. But if you're Asian, I'd certainly say watch your back. Now, I don't know if any of you lot know the current anti-terror legislation, but there's certain clauses in the legislation that are so ambiguous and so pathetic, it's ridiculous. Section 41 means you've been arrested, which is what me and Hisham were arrested for. Commission, preparation, instigation means absolutely nothing. When they told me that, I didn't know why I'd been arrested. I didn't know why I'd been arrested till maybe 10 o'clock at night. Okay, so that's section 41, but the main kind of worrying sections are section 57 and section 58. Now, if you've ever been to a talk where lawyers have been talking about current anti-terror legislation, then they'll have told you about section 57 and section 58. I'll sum up. Section 57 means possession of an article that can be of use to a terrorist, and section 57 is a collection of articles that can be used for the benefit of a terrorist in the commission, preparation, and instigation of an act of terrorism. And section 58 is just one article. Now, if I would have been charged, I would have been charged under Section 57 because I had lots of other documents, things downloaded from subversive websites like the Congress Research Service, the US Department of Justice, RAND Corporation, Federation of American Scientists, and World Politics and Foreign Affairs Journals. Section 58 would have been possession of the Al-Qaeda training manual. Luckily, because there was no nexus, there was no connection, there were no beheading videos, there were no ricin, and there were no detonators found in my house, I was not charged. Another one, glorification, Section 1, 2006 Terrorism Act. If you glorify an act of terrorism, what the hell does that mean? I mean, I spoke to Samina Malik's lawyer, the lyrical terrorist, John Burton, and I said to him, Cherie Blair empathising with suicide bombers in Palestine. Should she be prosecuted, or can she be prosecuted? I mean, the fact that he didn't answer me in public and then pulled me up in a corner after the conference and said, "Yeah, mate, she can, but don't say I said that." So I blatantly abused his trust. But apart from that fact, the point is that if Tony Blair's wife can glorify Palestinian terrorism, as some would call it, then, to be honest, the average folk has absolutely no chance. Section 1. And this is what academics really need to worry about, especially you as well, Vanessa, trouble causer. dissemination of terrorist... Section 2, dissemination of terrorist publications. Now, you could be an academic, right? And you could have a reading list. And on that reading list, you could have a website like the Department of Justice. Now, on that website, if they have the Al-Qaeda training manual, then theoretically, you can be arrested and detained for disseminating a website that has access or links to terrorist publications. Now, in theory, okay, like I said, this is probably not going to happen, but theoretically, it can happen. Okay, and the point is that I never thought that it would happen to me. The reason why I downloaded that document was because I was researching the damn thing. I wasn't using it to try and create something or try and blow something up. You know, I did it with the pure and most cleanest intention, but the point is that that didn't mean nothing. It didn't mean absolutely anything. So you could do something with the most clean-hearted intention, i.e. research, okay, and you could still be detained. So if you're an academic and you're listening, then I would be careful what you write on your reading list, especially if they've got subversive websites like the Federation of American Scientists. Because the manual is actually available on there, but don't access it because I'll be done for Section 1 glorification or dissemination for that fact. So yeah, don't do that. And another one about this glorification, I think it's great because it doesn't say that the terrorist organisation has to be present. So in theory, you could, or George Bush could be tried for this actually, because he's praised the American revolutionaries and they were considered terrorists. Nelson Mandela, considered a terrorist. So if you glorify Nelson Mandela, you could theoretically be arrested, detained, questioned and charged and imprisoned under the Terrorism Act 2006. That's how pathetic, ambiguous and bizarre this legislation is. Now, I mean, to be honest, Nottingham really has no action apart from shootings and, you know, a bit of crack cocaine here and there. So terrorism is a kind of new subject that's come to Nottingham. But I think that, I mean, I think most of us are already, you know, converted. So I'd say to you, look, continue to support the campaign. It's a long and hard struggle. We can't give up, because the point is that if they're using it against researchers at the moment, they could use it against absolutely anyone. They're using it against 85-year-old grannies who are campaigning against arms companies down south. Terrorism Act is being used to search 85-year-old grannies. That's how ridiculous this legislation is. And the point is that if you continue to support the campaign and to discuss and just talk about the damn thing, if you're sitting in the pub, just talk about it. You know, that's someone might just eardrop and might say, "Hang on, what's going off here? Oh, wow, that's bizarre." And they might read something on it. You know, they might go to The Guardian, comment is free. They might go to The Independent or The Times. Don't go to The Times. But yeah, they might read something about it. And you know, we're on a winner then. But the point is that you've got to continue the campaign. And not only that, but Hisham is in a very, very awkward position at the moment, as you all know if you've been following the campaign. The government is systematically trying to sabotage his reputation and his character, and have indulged in this kind of character assassination against him. Now, for the sake of an innocent man who's been sent to hell and back, I was detained for 6 days, and that nearly drove me mad. And I dread to think, what, 31 days in an immigration detention centre when you're refused some of the most basic rights, like a glass of water, how it would be. It drive me absolutely mad. So continue your struggle and continue to look, read, talk, listen about the current anti-terror legislation, and always continue to support Hisham, please. Thank you very much.